So we move to the next argument, and I'm pleased to introduce my co-chairman, Dr. Ileana Pina, and her talk would be about a probability issue, pathway to a more global device approval process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no disclosures other than consultant for the FDA. So several years ago, the Heart Failure Society, along with the FDA, put together a conference, a discussion conference, and we came up with this revealing statement that a device is not a drug, and trying to compare how difficult it is to do device trials when we have become so accustomed to doing randomized clinical trials, at least in the heart failure world, with drugs, and that we need to consider that endpoints may have to be different and recruitment may have to be different, and we've already had a good discussion here about it. Just briefly, for those of you who do not know the FDA's mission statement, the FDA is a branch of Health and Human Services. It is responsible for protecting the public health by assuring safety and efficacy and security of human veterinary drugs, products, and devices, including food supply. But we are also responsible for speeding the innovations and helping the public get the accurate, science-based information. And I want to thank my colleague, Andy Farr from the FDA, for some of his excellent slides, which I asked him if I could use, and he said yes, so he's sitting right here. There's this myth that the FDA sees Europe as an incubator for U.S. device development. In reality, the FDA really does seek the global approach to device development. We think they're feasible, we think that they're advantageous, and more we are being asked to review global trials where we are given U.S. data and OUS data, and we're asked to look at U.S. data and support it by the non-U.S. subjects. We think that we can assist. We have approaches to data poolability. We're willing to work with the statisticians of the companies to do this. And we think that that global approach will get the good devices to the patients faster. This has already started with pharmacotherapy. Even some of our NIH trials are now enrolling patients in Europe and enrolling them very successfully. And so we would like to mimic that by having good conversations, and I think the secret is having the conversations early. Dr. Fraser from the ESC wrote what we consider a very important paper of trying to establish some regulatory reform in the European system, and we commend the ESC's efforts to do this. Andy has been working very closely with Dr. Fraser and his team to be able to accomplish this. What is recommended, and I can tell you this comes directly from Bram Zuckerman, who's our director, he feels that the agency would like to meet with the sponsors early. The trial design needs to be clear, well-planned, strong, with a clear analysis plan ahead. This is a biggie for us, how to deal with missing data, and that needs to be discussed a priori. How to deal with background therapy, and we've had, I think, an excellent discussion about this here. And do the analysis jointly with both data, the U.S. and the OUS, with a trial design that is acceptable. Things that should be agreed upon are age. I love the discussion about the gender inclusion, since that's one of my pet peeves, that we don't get enough women in the same percentage to measure it with the disease process, and something that we have tried to do. The NIH has rules about it, and now we have rules about it at FDA as well. The assessment of New York Heart Association classification, which sounds so simple, is so difficult, and it is very subjective, and it can be biased. The assessment of functional capacity, we hear a lot, oh, it can't be done, patients don't want to do it, doctors don't want to do it, so we really have to be very consistent. And then the population to be chosen. A lot of trials now are looking at heart failure, period, whether it's low EF or preserved EF, so whether it's HFpEF or HFrEF, and we've had these discussions all along, should we include them or not, but that needs to be decided ahead of time. And are we going to stratify by etiology, ischemic, non-ischemic? We did that in our HF action. Background therapy stability, Bill showed a very nice definition of background therapy stability. We have a definition at FDA, which we keep modifying, and I can tell you we're adding the aldosterone-inhibiting agents to that definition based on the EMPhASIS trial and knowing that the new AHA guidelines will have that in there as a Class 1 recommendation. And, Bill, I think you were in that guideline committee. Other things that sound so simple, the hospitalization definition. How do you come up with one definition that everybody agrees? Roxana has led a group for heart failure hospitalization definition, which we have modified in the device section, and we now have a definition that we're happy to share. And part of the questions here, if you're enrolling patients who are in a heart failure or a disease management program, very often they don't get sent to the emergency department. They're seen in our office, and we can avert an admission very quickly. In the United States, Medicare is now considering, it's actually doing it. They consider heart failure an observation status. So if you keep the patient in the emergency department for 23 hours, they are not officially admitted. And so up front, we need to say, is this a hospitalization because there's a change in calendar date, period? Or are we going to take the aborted hospitalizations as somebody who would have shown up in the ED had they not been in a formal disease management program? Additional challenges. Trial design is a moving target, and very often the trial design, that the design of the device that we start with gets modified, usually for the good, and at the end of the trial we now have some modifications. Is the right heart failure population? We are now going to embark on the REVIVE trial, which is an NIH trial, looking at a less sick population. Who should be doing those studies, that less sick population, which is a very difficult population to define, and we met multiple times before coming up with the structure of this, I think, a very, very important protocol. Again, the control group needs to be carefully chosen, whether, again, Bill showed a nice selection of different types of control groups. And for my next talk, I'll be talking a little bit more about using a registry as a control group that is established. We have tried now to coordinate in the U.S. with Medicare because, obviously said, the patient population is over 65. This is a Medicare population, and if the device is going to get covered, we need to have those conversations with Medicare. And we have invited our Medicare colleagues into many of our own panels so that these conversations can be had ahead of time. And we recently had a wonderful panel, which Dr. Redberg chaired, looking at the coverage issues, and FDA was represented there as well. So in conclusion, FDA embraces the global vision. We believe that we can have a closer alignment in regulatory processes and that global approaches really are possible. I know of one trial already that is going on. I can't tell you what it is, but that we have had OUS data that we have looked at, and it's helping to support the U.S. Inclusion of the patient population. We strongly support the ESC recommendations, and we think that that reform is actually reasonable and would bring us closer. Most of all, we are very open to discussions. So I thank you.
So thank you for the presentation. As Europeans, we are happy not to be an incubator for USA. But since we're running late, we have just time for one or two very urgent questions.
This is John Darko from the New England Journal of Medicine. So I enjoyed that very much, but it occurred to me that I was anticipating you were going to say more about the subject of the fact that devices are not drugs, which I think is part of the thesis of this, the broader thesis of this session, which is just the question of what the differences are in trying to conduct a trial in the device setting versus the drug setting, and to what extent those differences might or might not justify a different approach. I can think of three differences. One of them is devices very often involve invasive procedures. Second, there's typically an element of expertise involved, particularly if there is an invasive procedure, which there isn't for administering a drug. And the third thing is that device development is very often an iterative process in which the prototype that gets tested initially is not, there are problems that are discovered, there are modifications that are made, there are revisions, and you have to test every one of those revisions. But I think that one of the questions surely should be, to what extent are any of these valid reasons for adopting a different approach to establishing a standard of evidence? Because I think that's what's being suggested, and it would be useful to know to what extent people think that's really the case.
I would just throw in that the fourth difference might be that the permanence of the procedure or the device, unlike a drug that can be withdrawn.
And I'll add to that the difficulty of blinding, which has already been discussed. And you're not going to do trials of 2,000 patients like we do in drug trials. So you're dealing with smaller numbers where you may not be able to have mortality as an endpoint.
Right.
But you have to find other clinically applicable endpoints that are not mortality. And we are very open to that. However, the part of the FDA's role is also no damage done. In other words, what you don't want to see is an increase in mortality. So mortality neutral, fine. No increase in mortality. So mortality does enter into it. And how long do you follow the patients? You're putting in a device that's forever. Is it 6 months enough or is 12 months enough? But again, we are very open, including things like adaptive design, which I know we have now had courses internally. And Andy, I don't know if you want to add more to that.
Well, I think it is a different paradigm because in addition to the differences that have been made by both you and Ileana is the amount of information we can get from non-clinical testing that is not applicable to the drug. So much of the bench testing, the engineering and the animal studies, and the idea that most of these devices have a local effect as opposed to a systemic effect. So those types of considerations give us a lot more information prior to getting into the patient about the actual device itself that informs us into the types of trials we need as well as interpretation of the trial results that are, you know, specifically to devices and differ from drugs.
Yeah, and I think if you look at historically, for example, in the LVAD world, which Bill also talked about briefly, we started out with randomized clinical trial. We moved to an objective performance criteria because there was enough in the literature to say this is what an LVAD mortality should look like. This is what the success rate, this is what the device malfunction should look like. Now we have moved into an active comparator, for example, in destination therapy, and we are looking anxiously into using Intermax, which I'll talk about a little bit more, which also has its problems, as Stuart has talked about registries. So I think that we have, the years that I've been there, I have seen the modifications happen.
I think these are good points. I just wanted to respond to a couple of things. One of them is, and I think your citing of the rematch trial is an illustration of the fact that at least, let's say perhaps in the initial evaluation of a new modality of therapy, that even in a setting where it appeared, and people who were involved in rematch can say what a difficult undertaking it was to bring about a randomized trial of a device as invasive and in a setting as difficult as late-stage heart failure, we're nonetheless able to carry out a very successful randomized trial in that setting, suggesting that we shouldn't discount our ability to carry out that kind of work. I think the question, in my view, then becomes, when you go to subsequent iterations, is it then reasonable to adopt a slightly different approach rather than having to repeat a randomized trial for every iteration that comes along? I think that, on the other hand, if you look at experiences like, let's say, the Fidelis lead, we know that there's such a thing as not enough testing. And I would take issue with the idea that the pharmacologists in drug therapy trials have less ability to predict what's going to happen with their therapeutic agents than the device therapies do. It's certainly possible to do a lot of testing on the bench, but that's a perfect example of a situation in which it didn't turn out to be sufficient.
Yeah, and I think, again, rematch comes back as a very excellent example of how the mortality that was seen there, and I think somewhat enhanced by inotropes in the control arm, which we know increased mortality. So if you remove the inotropes, maybe the survival may have been better. As the devices got better and better, that mortality has actually improved, I mean, significantly, even in the destination therapy. And so, and as the field moves, we don't do enough transplants. We don't have enough donors. But we have a huge number of sick patients that we have to find other ways to keep them going for whatever. Rita?
I agree. A drug is not a device. But I think for some reasons, perhaps we should be a lot more stringent about devices for some of the reasons we mentioned, because devices are invasive. They are implanted permanently. A drug, when we find out it actually doesn't work or it's dangerous, we can just stop it. We cannot do that for devices there when they're permanently implanted, which is a lot of cardiac devices. You know, I think when the FDA started regulating devices, we didn't have near the complexity and the number of devices that we have now, and that we really need to look hard because, as you said, we are now approving devices that are permanently implanted at significant risk on the basis of very small, very short-term studies. And that, you know, it's true, as John pointed out, even though we do clinical testing, if you've made a change and it is an iterative process, that change could be very serious and adverse, and Fidelis is only, unfortunately, one of many examples where the change has proved to be very dangerous to patients. And so I would suggest that the differences for devices to drugs mean that perhaps we need to be having longer-term, more rigorous clinical outcomes, you know, both pre-approval and post-approval, and that's a lead-in for your next talk.
I'm going to talk for the next one. Yes, by the way, when there is a device modification, we do know about it. The companies come to us and give it to us. And if we need to examine trial data based on the old modification, the new modification, that's also done. Andy, I don't know if you want to add anything more to that.
I think there are examples like the Mixo ring, and I don't know about others where that didn't occur.
Andy?
So I'm Andy Farb from FDA Division of Cardiovascular Devices, and I think the sentiments have been, you know, cover a lot of good points here that the device field is so dynamic versus drugs, and that there's not one size that fits all, and recreate the wheel for every iteration would unnecessarily, you know, slow down device improvement and device development. And so that we try to apply sort of smart thinking about what types of data are needed to evaluate a new change to a device and what that change is likely to affect in terms of the device's performance and its safety and effectiveness. So that if there was a one-year endpoint for a certain device on some hard clinical endpoint and then a device modification is made that it would affect delivery, but based on the comprehensive evaluation, unlikely to affect the other device performance measures, then the types of clinical data should be focused on evaluating that particular change. And the idea here is to apply, you know, risk-benefit types of thinking and risk analysis to the types of changes so that we don't necessarily just slow down any types of device improvements and get better devices out there.
Just have one last short comment, which I think we need to kind of consider, is that as devices improve and the iterations come in, I think we also know that the placebo arm also can improve. And one of the things that we sometimes forget is that we could have this placebo drift, if you will, and I think that's an important aspect. And I can only think of that in the realm of DES versus BMS. And while we have newer generation drug-eluting stents, the bare metal stents are so much better than they were when they first came out. And I'm wondering what the differential would be if we actually went back. And I think those are the kinds of things we need to consider as we are getting better and better in our devices, but so is the placebo arm as well. So I think that's an important thing to consider.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as heart failure drugs get approved, I think in a way we've kind of hit a ceiling. We had that rapid acceleration there for years, and we haven't really had a huge breakthrough. I mean, we have some things that are sort of hovering, but not a great, great breakthrough. So I don't see a huge difference on the optimal medical therapy side.